Across the Americas on Pan Am Saturn Galaxy, throughout Europe on the Astra satellite system, and around the world on shortwave and the internet, this is the Dutch International Service. Media Network Transatlantic Special. Jonathan Marks and Diana Jansen bring you our weekly communication survey direct from downtown Washington, D.C.
Hello, Diana and I are back again with half an hour of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting.
We start by taking you back to last Thursday morning and a significant announcement on the local public radio station.
38 degrees, and this is listener support at 88.5 FM WAMU Washington. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. The House has voted to cut taxes by $189 billion over 5 years. I'm Bob Edwards. Today is Thursday, April 6th, and this is NPR's Morning Edition.
While the House was cutting taxes, the U.S. Senate was preparing the largest spending cuts in recent years. Part of the $16 billion the Senate has since approved is a $35 million cut to U.S. international broadcasting. James Atherton, budget director for the Bureau for Broadcasting, explains that this could affect VOA, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio and Television Marti, and the recently proposed Radio Free Asia.
The bill now has to be conferenced by the House and the Senate together, and out of that will come the final amount that is either taken out of our appropriation or not for 1995. That's what makes it so difficult, because it's money that's already been appropriated to us, and we're halfway through our fiscal year. Our fiscal year runs October to October. So there's really not much program activity left during the rest of the year to take this money from. So it makes it very difficult for us.
So when will you finally know?
Well, they're on recess right now for another 3 weeks. So we'll have to wait until the recess is over and the bill goes to conference before we can really know exactly what will happen. But we're very nervous about it, needless to say.
But now we bring up the telephone line to Caversham Park in England, where Chris Greenway of BBC Monitoring is waiting. Chris, we understand that as well as possible budget cuts for the Voice of America, the Russian external service, the Voice of Russia, has already made another round of cutbacks. What are the details?
Yes, that's right. On the 5th of April, they cut back a further 8 languages, and this was rather an odd date for them to do it, because on the 26th of March, they had, like most other international broadcasters, introduced their new schedule for the summer 1995 period. But just 11 days later, they suddenly, and with very little notice, ceased broadcasting in Indonesian, Khmer, Nepalese, Sinhalese, Swahili, Tamil, Hausa, and Swedish. And furthermore, they reduced the broadcasting times in 17 other languages. And what this means is that the Voice of Russia is now only broadcasting in 30 languages for a total of 546 hours a week. Now, I was looking back at some calculations we made last year, and I found that last summer, for the summer 1994 schedule period, they were in fact on the air in 46 languages for well over 1,000 hours a week. They cut 8 languages last autumn, bring them down to 38 languages, but now they are really broadcasting for barely half the number of hours a week that they were on the air this time last year. So yes, a very, very significant cutback, and the reason they're giving for it is simply financial reasons.
The budget crunch must be severe, because those languages have the potential to reach hundreds of millions of people. But Chris, while you're on the line, there have been developments concerning the Caucasus. Does this mean there's going to be a new station on shortwave?
Well, that's right. For a little while now, we've been hearing vague reports and rumours that the Chechen rebels fighting Russian forces down in the Caucasus were planning to set up their own radio station. Well, now, on Tuesday of this week, a newspaper in Moscow actually carried a report about this from its correspondent in Warsaw in Poland, who said that he'd been in touch with the representative in Poland of the Chechen leader, Dzhokhar Dudayev, and the report said that in the very near future, possibly as early as next month, May, a Chechen radio station to be known as Radio Free Caucasus would go on the air from the Polish city of Krakow. And the plan is for the station to broadcast for at least 5 hours a day in Russian, Chechen, Georgian, Armenian, Azeri, and possibly even Polish. And all they're waiting for now is simply the official permission from the Polish authorities to do this. They say that they've got their equipment and studios already, and that they're getting support from Polish private organizations and some trade unions and a political party in Poland. And we could expect broadcast from them within a few weeks.
Can you mention some of the frequencies?
Well, they give no details of frequencies at all in this newspaper report, but other reports that I've seen have suggested that this could be on both medium wave and short wave.
According to information posted on the internet by Anne-Louise McCormick, the former pirate broadcaster Radio New York International is going back on the air, this time with a weekly one-hour programme of a shortwave station, WWCR, in Nashville. The first broadcast will air at 04 hours UTC on April the 30th, and the frequency there will be 7435 kHz. John Wright of the Australian Radio DX Club reports hearing a new frequency for the English transmission of Radio Pilipinas. The broadcast at 02 to 02:30 UTC uses the new frequency of 13760 kHz. The station broadcasts via the Voice of America relay station in Tanang. And today, the 13th of April, Radio France International starts broadcasting in the London area on 106.6 MHz until the 10th of May. RFI has previously broadcast in the British capital on a temporary basis. This latest 28-day licence has been granted in connection with the 50th anniversary of VE Day.
Radio Netherlands Media Network. We're right beside you.
For 2 days at the end of last week, 100 delegates from major international broadcasters around the world sat in the basement of the Voice of America building in Washington, D.C. They came together to find out how plans for digital audio broadcasting to mobile receivers is progressing. The digital revolution has already affected television, though. If you walk into an electronics store here in Washington, D.C., you can buy a receiver and a 60-centimeter dish, which gives you access to several dozen satellite-delivered subscription channels. In addition, a company called Digital Music Express, or DMX, has announced it will shortly offer 90 radio programs. As the name implies, there's very little information on the service. Still, you have to pay nearly $800 for the satellite receiver, plus $180 a year subscription.
International public broadcasters, on the other hand, want to reach portable radios and offer their programs for free. They're hoping to use frequencies around 1.5 gigahertz, often called the L-band, which were allocated at an international conference nearly 3 years ago. But it seems there's a major cost difference depending on whether listeners are using their portable radio at home or in the car. Four organizations turned up to try and persuade international broadcasters to use their system, although one of the contenders, RadioSat, clearly has developed nothing in the last 3 years. In contrast, Noah Samara, the president of WorldSpace, says their system is now taking shape.
Oh, absolutely. We have at least the DAB program that WorldSpace began about 5 years ago has now come almost a full circle. We have brought on board a major satellite manufacturing company, Alcatel of France, in a consortium that they will bring to deliver in space three satellites for us. And we also have brought on board Motorola to help us manufacture the radios. And we have now brought on board also Morgan Stanley to begin to organize the financing for the company.
Aren't you a bit concerned, though, that the frequencies originally allocated for this in 1.5 gigahertz, other people are starting to look at that frequency spectrum and saying, well, maybe it could be used for terrestrial use, or maybe it could be used for national, not international broadcasting.
While that is the case, many of the countries in the developing world cannot afford to actually put a terrestrial system in place. In fact, one of the problems in Africa is that the terrestrial systems that are presently in place and has taken Africa over the last 30 years to put in place are actually not covering the entire continent. About 30% of the continent is not covered by indigenous terrestrial broadcasting. So the option for much of the developing world is satellite. And if it's satellite, many of the developing countries can't afford to put up their own satellite. So they're looking to common user solutions, which we provide.
Or will provide by 1998. Gordon Harrell is an engineering advisor to BBC World Service in London. He explains that at the moment, only one experimental satellite system's been tested. Voice of America, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, carried out tests a while back and concluded that you'll have to use your satellite radio near a window in order to get any reception at all.
The rest of the systems have not yet been tested, and that's what we're looking forward to in the next 6 to 9 months.
Is that a bit worrying in the sense that people putting all sorts of project proposals, but at the end of the day we still don't know whether DAB is going to penetrate into a room like this which hasn't got any windows?
No, you're absolutely right. It's something that has to be tested. I mean, if you take the work that's been going on within the Inmarsat organisation, they of course have a lot of experience of operating L-band satellites, and they are in the process of developing this sort of combined integrated services, data services system, and they are expecting to be doing some tests with that system within the next few months. They have got test receivers built, and we'll see what comes out of that. In the case of WorldSpace, for example, the Motorola people are developing receivers now, and in fact are intending to do some tests at L-band again over some satellites at the end of the year. And of course the Eureka people, whose system has been extensively tested in the terrestrial DAB scene, is going to be tested both from a helicopter simulating the satellite position in Europe, and hopefully as well on L-band on one of two satellites around the globe again within the next few months.
Frank Kozamirnik is a senior engineer at the European Broadcasting Union in Geneva.
The whole purpose of this conference is to clarify which system could be put on the satellite, and we've got now several system options here, and I must say personally I'm quite confused now because there are so many different proposals. Now, ideally, not only for Europe but worldwide, we should end up with a single system, and since a number of countries worldwide will use Eureka terrestrially, it is quite natural that the first thing to test is whether or not Eureka system is suitable for satellite delivery to mobile receivers. The EBU has done a lot of studies on that, and we are quite convinced that the Eureka system not only can be technically suitable for satellite delivery, but is the most spectrum and power efficient system to portable and mobile receivers.
Very important, bearing in mind that as people travel around at the moment, they have to take a shortwave radio with them, which works anywhere in the world. It would be a shame indeed if that whole portability were to disappear because Europe was using the Eureka 147, and let's say America was using the IMOX system, and Africa was using something completely different.
We would like to avoid this deadlock of having different system approaches. The system works under tunnels. I tested it in the third cellar of the CICG building in Geneva. It worked superbly well. Just a few reflections there, but sufficient to capture the signal. So I'm quite confident that the system works, even if there is no line of sight.
Terry Hargreaves, director of Radio Canada International, says his country has already chosen for Eureka 147 for its domestic service.
I think we're a bit further along, but it is a long haul, and the complexities are quite astounding. But I think that gradually we begin to see our way clearly through. And in Canada, for instance, we adopted the Eureka 147 some time ago, same as Mexico did. And there's a consortium of the public broadcaster in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, of which we are a part, and all the commercial stations who have agreed to work towards implementing DAB for national broadcasting within Canada. So I think that's a fairly positive reaction in our country.
When do you expect receivers to be in the shops, though?
Ah, well, then, when somebody designs a receiver, and then somebody says, we'll design the receiver when you put the programs out. However, as you know, the BBC is starting in the fall, and I think that will be a very good sign. There's lots of tests. We've been running tests, the Germans, the French, everybody else has. So I think it's one of those things that will move along, and it's down different paths, but I hope we'll all end up at the same place. Certainly we all hope that we'll end up with a receiver that, as now with radio, that wherever you are in the world, you'll be able to utilize it. And that's something we should really strive for.
Derek White of Radio Australia is concerned that while some broadcasters may be able to afford new digital satellite technology, they could leave listeners behind.
Well, that's certainly one of the things that's been highlighted at the conference. There are very different markets between the affluent Western societies, and particularly the development that's gone into very complicated systems designed essentially for Europe, and the needs of the developing countries in Asia and in Africa. I'm encouraged to think that the price of a set is beginning to come down and beginning to look more reasonable by any stretch of the imagination. They still look expensive for third world countries, but they're not beyond the reach of at least part of the population.
The first receivers will cost around $200. Noah Samara says they have plenty of interest from receiver manufacturers who want to use the specialized integrated circuits being made for WorldSpace by Motorola. Samara wants 3 million receivers in the marketplace in 4 years' time.
Much of what we're doing right now is firming up the building blocks to getting there before you get to the equipment manufacturers, who will then take a Motorola chip and integrate it into their own multi-band radios. You have to have the Motorola or someone like Motorola to come in and agree to make the chips themselves. Motorola's now, you know, behind that. But essentially, from a manufacturer's point of view, it's very easy for them to take the chip that Motorola or other people would build under OEM and other arrangements. It's very easy for that manufacturer to take that chip and integrate it into multi-band radios.
There's one point, though, at this particular conference, disagreement amongst the technicians as to if, for example, I'm in Nairobi 5 years from now and I've got one of your receivers, the Starman receiver, and I'm inside a concrete building, will I be able to hear the broadcast, or do indeed I have to go outside on a balcony so that I can actually see the satellite above me?
There is very concrete data to show today that there are other L-band systems, L-band being the frequency under which we operate. There are many other systems like the global positioning system of the U.S. navigation system, pagers, satellite paging. All of these things work inside a building environment. You won't be able to hear it inside a room that doesn't have a window. You may not be, most likely won't be able to hear it in a basement type of an environment. Under those scenarios, we believe the users of the system will be cooperative users, in that they would want to listen to the signals or to the various programs on the radio sufficiently enough to actually want to take an antenna and augment it, an antenna that would be facing the satellite and augment it to their radio.
In the similar way that shortwave listeners put out an antenna now?
Exactly. It's exactly what people do right now.
But what about the danger that WorldSpace may be working on a radio which is incompatible with other satellite systems?
The reason we have designed this type of a radio is to get as inexpensive a radio as possible into our marketplace, which doesn't have the kind of buying power that the other types of radios are being proposed for, particularly for Europe. That said, our radio will also, we are now looking at convergence technologies between our radio design and what is known as the Eureka 147 radio design. And those convergences will allow certain users that buy certain radios, in other words, more high-end radios that would be able to travel across continents, that would at least be able to pick up European signals when the traveler is in Europe, as well as African or Asian or Latin American signals under the WorldSpace system when the traveler is in those regions.
And last but not least, when are you going to be able to hear Radio Netherlands, for example, via the AfriSpace system? When do you expect launch and delivery?
AfriSpace, we expect that to be launched in first quarter of 1998 for AfriSpace, third quarter of 1998 for Asia Space, and first quarter of 1999 for Carib Space, which covers the Caribbean and all of Latin America.
Well, more news from this groundbreaking DAB conference in upcoming editions of the program as we delve into the compression techniques called MPEG. But now, looking at the calendar, we're off on another topical journey.
Music, but from where? Alfonso Montalegre and Jaime Bagina of our sister program in Spanish called Radio Enlace have just got back from a visit to one of the most remote places in the world, Easter Island, or Rapa Nui, as the inhabitants call it. The first European to have a look round the island was the Dutch Admiral Jacob Roggeveen in 1722. More than a century later, in 1888, the island was annexed by Chile. Now Rapa Nui is a tiny island of only 163 square kilometers, right in the Pacific, 3,600 kilometers west of Chile. I asked Alfonso how long it took him to get there.
Well, it takes 5 hours on a jet plane from Chile, from Santiago. It's very far away, yes.
And what's the island like? Is it hot? Is it volcanic?
It's a subtropical island, just a little bit south of the Tropic of Capricorn, with a subtropical climate. It is never cold there. It is very nice, with a lovely breeze, and it's very nice temperature.
Horses and four-wheel drive vehicles are needed for local transport, because there are few paved roads. So what attracts the tourists?
People come there to see the island, to see the moais, which are giant statues carved in volcanic rock, and to see how the people live there, which is very, very interesting.
But for you, there was also another reason for going to Easter Island. You wanted to see the NASA base.
Yes, I have heard 5 years ago some news about the NASA building there, and I was very interested and very intrigued by that. Actually, they built a base which is in charge of monitoring satellites, low orbit and high orbit satellites.
How does it work?
Well, they have a green laser beam. It goes up and then it catches the satellite, to say like that, and it is reflected back to the Earth. You can see how it shines like a star.
And how do the locals react to that?
Well, like if they are seeing Martians, because there are many stories going around in the island, because the activities are at night, after midnight. A lot of people gather in their surroundings and they are very scared. Some of them are laughing, of course, about that, but many of them are scared and they really think people from outer space are coming every night to Easter Island.
Arel Uenchuyan is an engineer at the NASA base. He explains which types of satellites they monitor.
Well, mainly two kinds of satellites. The highest one, which are around 6,000 kilometers, they are supposed to be used for measuring the movement of the different plates of the Earth. That's the original purpose of this the entire network. But lately, this data has been used for lower satellites that are used for the level of the water of the ocean. For doing that, we determine the exact altitude of the satellite.
It's important that researchers know the exact orbit of scientific satellites involved in remote sensing. If they are to continuously measure minute continental drifting or higher waves as a result of the greenhouse effect, you must measure from the same point in space. NASA also built a runway on Easter Island for a possible emergency landing by the space shuttle, when and if it is on a polar orbital mission.
Because the sky is very clear, you see millions of stars, and there's a very, very nice atmosphere going around. No noises at all, no planes, no cars, even no insects, because there are not many insects there. And then you see this laser beam going up, and then you see the satellite, the low orbit satellites reflecting the light. It's wonderful. It's a very, very nice experience. And seeing these people walking around with walkie-talkies and connecting and transmitting what they are saying to each other, because the one who is maneuvering this big telescope, he cannot see anything, but the guy which is outside is following the operation. He's reporting what he's seeing.
See? In este momento empieza a apuntar al target.
Easter Island is extremely remote, as we said, but electronically you can reach them in seconds.
Yes, they have a very modern umbilical cord with the world. I couldn't believe it myself, they have internet.
We have it since 8 months now, and it's working very good. The link itself is from here, the site to the town Hangaroa on the island is a microwave link, and then from the Hangaroa town to the continent is a satellite link. And then in Santiago, we connect to the rest of the world via the internet.
And your internet address is?
Charlie Echo Charlie Uniform X-ray 1 dot Charlie Echo Charlie dot U Charlie Hotel India Lima Echo dot Charlie Lima. The username is Awenchu, which is Alpha Hotel Uniform Echo November Charlie Hotel Uniform.
Being there in the middle of nowhere with South America to the east and the Pacific to the west, it must have been shortwave heaven.
Yes, it was. I couldn't believe my ears. It was like the same experience I had many years ago in Lapland in northern Europe. And I heard there medium wave stations from Peru.
Tahiti booms in on 19 meters.
Ia homa yo rana tatu it whare rit ai te I e taram hanai ro tua I te fan hot a vuur a pru a pi na tatu.
I have listened to remote stations as far away as Colombia and Canada, northern Canada, and you can listen to the Southeast Asia, to Japan, to South America, and the Seychelles, of course.
Is there any radio and television on the island itself?
Well, there is television now. The moment I came there, it was a very old system. They got cassettes 2 or 3 days later with some of the programs from Chile, which is the mother country. And now they have a satellite link, and they get, I think, 3 or 4 channels from the continent, South America. Well, they have radio more or less the same way. They have 2 stations, which were built by, respectively, the Navy and the Air Force. The Navy station is called Radio Vaicava, which is transmitting on FM. The frequency is 98.5 megahertz. And they have local produced programs, only musical programs. And they have a satellite link with Radio Finissima from Santiago. And they have some hours of the day they are transmitting the programs.
Durante el programa, en fin. Así que esté atento ahí a la sintonía de Vaicava FM, la del sonido estéreo digital, que llega a cada rincón de Rapa Nui con su música, pues. Ya, vayan, yo lo espero.
The same happened with Radio Manukena, which in the local language means shouting bird. And this Radio Manukena is was built a property of the Air Force, and it's located very near the airport. They use also transcription programs from radio stations like Radio Netherlands, and they have our Europarade program, music program, which is very popular in all South America. They have also a satellite link some hours a day with the continent, and they transmit the programs of Radio Cooperativa from Santiago. And it's very funny to listen that there is a time difference of 2 hours. Actually, from the geographical point of view, it must be 4 hours difference, but they reduce it to 2 hours, so they are physically more close to the island.
And the local stations, do they broadcast in Spanish or in the local language?
They have mostly, I think, 90% Spanish transmissions, but they have also in Rapa Nui language. They transmit some programs, yes. And a lot of music from the Pacific region.
Rapa Nui, that's also the name of the island itself.
It's the name of the island. It was the islanders call it Rapa Nui, which means the navel of the earth.
Radio Manukena transmite la frecuencia de 101.7 megahertz.
Diario de Cooperativa presenta su cuarta edición con el resumen informativo del día que acaba de terminar.
But there's media news from the island as well.
Oh yes, there are. This is a frequency of 580 kilohertz, which is medium wave, and it's the frequency of Radio Manukena, which is inactive at the moment. But there are plans to go on the air again on 580 very soon.
sounds like a fun place to be. If you speak Spanish, Radio Enlace will carry more details about Easter Island in their edition next week here on Radio Netherlands.
Now over to Melbourne, where Mike Bird is waiting with the propagation review. Mike, what's it been like over the last 7 days?
Well, Diana, the geomagnetic field was very stormy between Friday and Saturday. This disturbed the ionosphere, particularly those higher frequencies. Solar activity was low all week. The solar flux ranged between 72 and 78. The average works out to 73.1, which equals an effective sunspot number of 10, and that is down on the previous week's level of 15. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, ranged between 4 and 78, which represents quiet to major storm conditions. The magnetic field was quiet until 3 hours UTC on Friday when a storm started. This storm lasted until 18 hours UTC on Saturday when it quietened to unsettled to active conditions, which in turn lasted until Tuesday. During the storm on Friday and Saturday and even into Sunday, the ionosphere was badly disturbed.
And what about between now and next week, April the 20th?
Well, we've got everything crossed for a quiet week, Diana. IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will remain low and the geomagnetic field should be generally quiet to unsettled. That's if nothing pops up on the sun.
Thanks for the warning, Mike. We close with correction. It seems we misinterpreted the rather unusual email address of Radio Australia. So if you want to send them a message, here's the correct internet address. It's raust3@ozemail.com.au. Do remember the figure 3 just before the at sign. Maybe that address was computer generated.
For now, that's all from this Media Network Transatlantic special. Jonathan and I wish you a pleasant weekend.
Input on the output to Radio Netherlands, P.O. Box 222, 1200 JG, Hilversum, the Netherlands. Or fax your fax to Hilversum 724-239.